At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Okay, give me three adjectives to describe your boss.
Schizophrenic, enigmatic, great.
Supportive, respectful, team player.
I'll say generous, hardworking, creative.
Brown noser.
Hey, whatever works. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, supporting America's public transportation systems, working to help reduce greenhouse gases for a better environment at publictransportation.org. And by Bank of America, believing that healthy communities and a healthy planet are essential to creating opportunities for everyone. Bank of America, Bank of Opportunity.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Glad to have you with us on this, the third day of September. We'll be devoting most of today's show to that special species of laborer known as the boss. But first, some encouraging news for Americans on this Labor Day. You can take it easy. You've earned the rest. A survey out today from the International Labor Organization in Geneva concludes that Americans are the most productive workers on the planet. From the European desk in London, Stephen Beard has more.
The average American worker, says the ILO, produces more than $63,000 worth of output a year. That's more than three times the global average. And it's more than 10% ahead of the most productive countries in Europe. The key, according to labour market economist Ian Brinkley, lies in America's love affair with new technology.
The Americans have been much better at getting productivity out of the new technologies that have come on stream over the past decade. That's partly because America has a lot more in terms of high-tech manufacturing industry, but also they've been a lot better at applying it in more traditional sectors.
Among the other reasons for America's productivity lead over Europe, says the ILO, is the generally more competitive climate in the US and the fact that Americans work longer hours and take fewer vacations. But people in Asian countries like China and South Korea spend even more time at work. And though their productivity is still relatively low, it's accelerating faster than anywhere else. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Also on this Labor Day, a group claiming to represent thousands of New York cab drivers is planning a strike. Drivers are protesting a new high-tech system they say will cost them time and money. Marketplace's Amy Scott has that story.
By the start of next year, all 13,000-plus yellow cabs in New York will be required to install fancy new equipment, a video screen passengers can watch in the back seat, a credit card payment system, and a global positioning device. Many owners say they can't afford the $7,000 installation cost or the credit card transaction fees. They worry the city will use the GPS to track their every move. If the strike goes ahead early Wednesday morning, driver William Guerra says he plans to stay home.
I got a family to support, and we don't make so much money in this business.
Plenty of drivers oppose the strike. Kamran Khawaja already has the new gear in his cab. He says it's made his job much easier.
I used to write down everything. When you enter my taxi, when you leave it, how much you paid me, right? Now I don't need anything to write down.
The group organizing the strike represents just a fifth of the city's licensed drivers, and dozens of unofficial car services may be only too happy to pick up the slack. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Investors took a breather this holiday as they recover from a summer of turmoil, but the rest of the world kept trading, so we'll have those details when we do the numbers. No doubt those cabbies in New York have spent some time trying to figure out how to get what they want from their bosses. Perhaps they could take a cue from the new FX show Damages, where two characters recently tried to figure out what might make law firm honcho Patty Hughes appreciate their efforts.
Tom, listen. With certain bosses, the Patties of the world, the only way to earn their respect is to show them that you don't need them, that you got something going on for yourself that's better than being at their beck and call.
And if that doesn't work, well, Gil Schwartz, a.k.a. Stanley Bing, has written several books about bossdom, including his latest, Crazy Bosses. Mr. Bing, thanks for being here.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Now, of course, in your real life, Mr. Mm-hmm. Gil Schwartz, you're a manager, so I'm wondering...
Oh, please, don't demote me. I'm an executive vice president.
Oh, you are a super-duper manager.
Exactly. I am what I used to make fun of.
All right. Well, so given that, has kind of all your research caused you to analyze yourself as a boss?
Well, constantly, because I'm also a narcissist. So, you know, I'm always interested in myself and... Actually, I've noticed in many ways, like one of those science fiction movies, you know, where people, the mad scientist tests things on himself and at the end goes completely out of his mind. That's kind of a genre that I understand because, you know, when I began in business, I won't say I was sane, but I was relatively rational and understood kind of, you know, sort of my place in the universe. But I noticed that as I get to be more and more of a boss and have more and more people that I'm responsible for and in a way too, if you know what I mean. I notice that I'm now displaying in gorgeous technicolor many of the things that I write about.
So you talked about performing some tests on yourself as a boss. Mm-hmm. Can you give me an example?
Well, here's one that I think not only bosses but anybody could try on themselves. How long can you bear to be away from your BlackBerry?
The CrackBerry?
The CrackBerry. I see people, you know, in the street, and, you know, between the cell phone and the BlackBerry, no one's actually in the moment.
But how does that affect what kind of boss you are?
Well, what that does is that feeds control freaks with a constant, steady stream of stuff that needs to be controlled. That's what's making people more crazy. And what happens is that everybody goes crazy in a different way. In other words, some people get extremely morose. Other people get very paranoid. You know, it's really like a graded scale of pathology, but it all comes from the same root source, which is, you know, basically personalities under too much duress.
So this is kind of how you've analyzed yourself as a manager, as a big-time boss. What about how you analyze the people above you?
Well, they're exemplary people, and I admire them very much.
Is it review time for you?
No, I analyze everybody, and I know I hope that it makes me a better employee, if you know what I mean.
Stanley Bing, or Gil Schwartz, whatever your name is, thanks so much for coming in.
Tess, I really enjoyed it. Thanks.
We're always hearing from the management gurus that the best way to get ahead at work is to just put yourself out there. Employees who assert themselves and are more vocal are the ones who are going to excel. March to a different drummer and the boss will notice you. But commentator Richard Conniff disagrees. He says workers are better off standing together than standing out.
American culture is built on the myth of rugged individualism, marching to the beat of a different drummer, doing our own thing in our own time, being the lone wolf. But who are we kidding? Rugged individualism is a recipe for disaster. At Procter & Gamble, a former executive once declared, "If eagles fly alone, they shoot them down." Biology and common sense encourage us to become like the people around us. We actually have mirror neurons in our brains dedicated to imitation. So two people in a friendly conversation often match each other's body language down to the waggling of their feet. It feels good, a way of saying, "I'm with you." We like a conversational partner more if the other person has subtly mimicked us. Making the same gestures and movements also seems to help people work better together. We find a shared rhythm and gradually coalesce into a team. The mirror response can also save your neck. Let's say you're standing around with coworkers griping about your boss Thimblebrain. Then you spot Thimblebrain bearing down on you. A look of alarm flashes across your face and leaps to the faces of the people around you, causing the conversation to die away just in time. And all this happens before anybody can say, "It's him!" Sure, conformity can be dangerous. It leads to groupthink. Look at NASA, where engineers have twice given the go-ahead to doomed space shuttles. But working in groups is human nature. We're just not built to go it alone. The trick is to make the group a safe place for people to say, "Hang on, we need to think this through again." Henry David Thoreau was undoubtedly right to say that a man should step to the music which he hears, however measured or far away. But biology adds that we almost always find that music in the company of other people.
Richard Conniff is author of The Ape in the Corner Office. It's time for our yearly job reviews here at Marketplace, and I just want to publicly let my bosses know what an honor it is to work here and how svelte you all are looking these days. How about a round of golf? Just kidding, you don't want to hit the links with me. But it certainly is a popular way to schmooze with the boss. Dozens of articles online and in business journals painstakingly detail how to impress your boss on the links. Reporter Jane Lindholm thought it might be worth a shot.
I started by renting Caddyshack. Great flick. Then I rang up business expert Seth Godin to find out whether or not golf really is still important in the corporate world.
Getting the boss to like you, getting your customers to like you, is always going to be important.
Then I drove over to the Wilshire Country Club to see about a membership. I didn't even get past the guard. He took one look at my dusty 97 Toyota Corolla and laughed. I'm not kidding. He actually laughed in my face. And then he pointed me to the exit. But not before informing me that it cost $150,000 to join and $20,000 a year for a membership. So let's be honest, the exit was really my only option anyway. But I'm an intrepid journalist. I can't be beaten down by one, all right, five snooty Los Angeles country clubs. There has to be another way. My boss has a teenage son, and she seems pretty impressed by the virtual world games he likes to play. So why not give that a try? Ed Castronova is the author of Synthetic Worlds, The Business and Culture of Online Games. He says there are 37 million golfers in the U.S. and 148 million video gamers. And he told me that in one way at least, gaming is even better than golf.
This would be sort of like a golfing environment that you can instantly teleport yourself into it at any moment.
Castronova also pointed out that I don't need to worry about the status of my car in the virtual world. I may not have tons of money, but I've got my youth.
There is a leveling effect where younger professionals know everything. They're experts. They've zoomed ahead, and they're at the top of the social hierarchy, and here's the 55-year-old fumbling with the very basics.
I'm in that younger, zooming, expert demographic, but I've never played any of these games. I drove up to San Francisco and called in on my childhood friend Peter Galesian. He's now a contract computer programmer. He couldn't believe I thought golf was still relevant.
Do doctors and lawyers still do that? Like, if you graduate from Stanford Law, do you have to, you know, get a minor in golf?
So he graciously offered to show me around the neighborhood in one of these virtual worlds.
To battle! Run!
The game is called World of Warcraft. It's a standard, massively multiplayer, online role-playing game where you go in and you take a role as a whatever kind of character you want to be.
Nearly 7 million people play World of Warcraft. Most of them, like Pete, belong to what are called guilds, groups of guys and girls on their computers typing life into their characters. There are priests and druids and night elves, and they basically go around slaying dragons and other creatures. But that doesn't answer whether or not games can mimic the role of golf as a way to network or make deals. Pete was skeptical himself, but I asked him if he would ever use the game in a similar manner.
If I was looking for a job, I would make that known to my guildmates. In the guild, you know people and you know what they do with their life, and hopefully they have a good opinion of you from their interaction with you in-game, and it is networking.
I'm not sure I can see myself slaying dragons with my boss, so I checked out another virtual reality game called Second Life. This one looks a lot more like real life. There are shops and homes and cars, and in the crowd at the Second Life convention last month, I found the guy who created golf in Second Life.
I'm Kanker Greenacre in World, and Leslie Voschel out of World.
Voschel's version of golf is just like the real thing, except, of course, that it's on the computer. There are 9 beautifully manicured holes, a clubhouse, membership dues, but it only costs about $1 to play for 3 hours. That's a far cry from the country clubs I was turned away from. Voschel works in the aerospace industry. He says he would never invite his boss to play around in Second Life. So there goes my theory, right? Well, not so fast. He may not want to invite his real-life boss, but he's not above using golf to climb the virtual social ladder. He built his simulation to impress another top exec, the creator of Second Life itself.
I've always had in the back of my mind the fact that Philip Linden wanted to have a golf game in Second Life. So I'm sure all the content creators are like, how can we appease Philip Linden or, you know, get him on our good side?
So I guess it all depends on who you're trying to impress. If your boss is a tech-savvy, forward-thinking mover and shaker, as mine is, she might be up for a little virtual world schmoozing. But then again, she might not. Bottom line for me is, I guess I'm going to have to let my work speak for itself. In Los Angeles, I'm Jane Lindholm for Marketplace.
Coming up, high drama hits the corporate boardroom.
If thou didst ever thy dear father love...
Oh, God!
Revenge his foul and most unnatural murder!
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 But first, let's do the numbers. U.S. traders took the day off, and apparently the rest of the financial world took that as a cue to take it easy. In light trading, Japan's Nikkei fell about 0.3%. In Hong Kong, the Hang Seng also lost 0.3%. European shares fared a little bit better, with London's FTSE and the German DAX inching upward. In France, the CAC 40 fell 0.2% after news of a long-awaited merger between Gaz de France and Suez, creating the world's third-largest power and gas company. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. And by Siemens, from generators that power cities to light bulbs for homes, from factory automation to medical diagnostics. Siemens, 70,000 U.S. employees providing solutions for America. Ever hear a song on Marketplace, but you just can't place it? Or maybe it's the first time you've heard it and you want to hear it again. Just click on the archive section of our website. We list the songs we play on every show in that day's rundown. There's even a link to an online store where you can buy the song and help fund public radio programming. It's all at marketplace.org.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Tuesday. Congress is back to work. The Senate Armed Services Committee tackles the tricky subject of detainee treatment. President Bush travels to Sydney, Australia for an economic summit.
And on this day, more than two centuries ago, a group of 44 settlers founded the city of Los Angeles. The city's population is now nearing 4 million. I'm Jennifer Collins.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal. Think you have a tough boss? Well, at least you didn't have to work for Meryl Streep's character in The Devil Wears Prada.
So sorry, Miranda. I actually did confirm
the tales of your incompetence do not interest me.
Ouch. So how do you deal with a demanding boss who won't take no for an answer? First thing, you say no. Dr. Dori Hollander is the founder of Wise Workplaces. It's a management consulting and executive coaching firm. And Dori, isn't saying no an incredibly hard and risky thing to do?
Well, it is, and it really shouldn't be. That's why this is such an important topic, because most people have it all turned around. We're so afraid to say no, when in fact it's saying yes repeatedly that's the real danger. If you indiscriminately say yes, you're going to get a lot of things that you're charged with that are not part of your job description.
If you are saying yes to something, is it appropriate to ask for something in return?
Certainly. And that's the problem with people who habitually say yes. They don't ask for anything in return. They simply do it. And they do it uncomplainingly to the person, but complainingly to everyone else, which doesn't help. So the thing to do is to say, I have a lot on my plate, and it's really hard for me to do this, but I'm really happy to do this favor for you, and I will make it work. But you know, you owe me. And laugh. They'll get it. You don't need to say any more than that. They'll get it. Part of what they owe you could be taking something off your plate so you can help them. The other piece, Tess, of this that I think is in everybody's blind spot who doesn't say no is they think the boss is going to really be upset if they say no.
Right. Absolutely. It's a risk.
It's always a risk, especially if you have a bully boss. But if you have a sort of average, run-of-the-mill boss, not great, not terrible, that boss would rather have you say no and not do a poor job. I work with lots of bosses in the work I do.
Lucky you.
And they all say, I mean, well, they want me to do everything. But, you know, I mean, they'll say, of course, I want people to say no, because the last thing I want is somebody to say yes and not do it well, not do it on time. You know, I want them not only to say no, but I want them to say, no, I can't do that. I really feel pigeonholed if I do that. It's something I used to do 5 years ago, and I really want to grow and develop. Can you find something for me that I'm going to really like and go up a learning curve on? And a lot of bosses say, I want a person like that.
Well, Dori Hollander, thank you for saying yes to coming in and talking with us.
You think I should have said no?
Absolutely not. We're very glad you said yes.
I'm glad I said yes, too.
What can Major League Sports teach you about being better managers and business people? What can the Beatles teach you about team building? Seems like everyone and their basketball coach has a business world lesson for us, including Shakespeare. That's right. William Shakespeare was the theme of an annual CEO retreat outside Boston, a day-and-a-half-long seminar run by something called CEO Roundtable. Marketplace's Sean Cole tagged along to learn how to turn the boardroom into a bard room.
CEO Roundtable is sort of like a support group for CEOs. They get together monthly and talk about CEO stuff, personnel problems, startup successes and failures, and then once a year they have a kind of CEO Lollapalooza, usually with a theme, which this year was Hamlet.
To be or not to be. That is the question. Whether it is...
Hopefully they weren't planning to use the play to teach effective decision-making. The whole thing was led by Tina Packer, artistic director of a theater out in the Berkshires called Shakespeare and Company. She started by explaining the title of the seminar.
Which is Will.
Shakespeare's first name, of course. But in Elizabethan times, Will meant a couple of other things, like...
Sexual desire. You didn't know that, did you? It can also mean the sexual parts, but we won't go down there or explain anything to do with that.
Thank goodness. And then there's the reason everyone was there.
The will to power. And how is it that you can be empowered with your will, and how much will are you willing to exert?
The real question is, how are CEOs going to learn to wield power expertly and benevolently from a sullen, vengeful little Dane like Hamlet, particularly when most of them aren't familiar with the source material?
My relationship to Shakespeare, in a word, is rusty.
Distant.
Non-existent.
Abandoned after my convent high school.
Well, Shakespeare is the company that makes my fishing equipment.
Luckily, Packer brought two of her actors along to perform the play for them in 10 minutes. Wigs and swords flying everywhere.
Hamlet, here are your letters back. Because to the noble mind, rich gifts wax poor when givers prove unkind there.
You bitch. Get me to a nunnery.
What?
From there, it was breakout group time. No management retreat is complete without its breakout groups. Discussion questions ranged from, is Claudius a good crisis manager? Why? To, what is your obligation to ghosts and their unfinished business? For people who haven't read Hamlet in like 30 years, if at all, the CEOs really dove into the material, some of them mulling over the to-be-or-not-to-be speech.
Yeah, but it strikes me as he had a very narrow set of options that he was considering. He could have formed consortiums, he could have
rallied together his allies and taken on the president of the company, Claudius, who, according to one of the more Shakespeare-knowledgeable CEOs, Mark Lautenberger, should never have graduated from management school.
So, Claudius as a crisis leader. Yes or no? We say thumbs down. He hadn't built any coalitions, asked for any help, communicated to anybody. He
just let his guilt and shame eat him up inside, occasionally exploding in emotional outbursts, which is also what happened to Hamlet because he let the ghost of his father linger around too long, unavenged. Another CEO, Barbara Dove, says everybody has ghosts like that.
With ghosts, what do you do with them? Well, some people say deal with them. Do something about it. You can make the choice of whether to kill Cassius or not.
No.
Claudius, thank you. Begins with C.
One of the members said the play reminds him of problems he was having with his board. Lauren Carlson, the CEO of CEO Roundtable, had already thought of that analogy.
What I have experienced where a member didn't see the assassin coming, didn't know that something was rotten on the board of Denmark.
And, you know, fun retreat until after lunch when the whole seminar turned a lot darker and more serious. Essentially, Packer asked the group to remember a time when they were truly afraid. And not just to remember it, but to really return to the scary thing in their minds and feel it as fully as when it happened. And by way of example, Packer's two actors performed the scene where Hamlet's dead father appears before him. Kevin Coleman played the father, real tears gathering around his eyes.
If thou didst ever thy dear father love...
Oh, God!
Revenge his foul and most unnatural murder!
Murder!
Murder! Most foul!
Suddenly, I was crying. Which is crazy, because these were the words of a fictional ghost that Shakespeare dreamed up 400 years ago. Whatever the actor was thinking about, the emotion was real. And I thought to myself, I can't even get through 10 minutes of Hamlet without falling apart. I would make the worst CEO in the world. But Tina Packer says swallowing that despair, or whatever, is just going to desensitize you. And the world doesn't need another inhuman boss.
And in this idea of will and willpower, which we spoke about at the beginning, that there is, if you have the power to be vulnerable, you actually can use your vulnerability for great strength. Not only for yourself, but for other people.
So in that sense, maybe I'd make the best CEO in the world. Except that I really don't know whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune or to take arms against a sea of troubles and by opposing end them. In Boston, I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a diversified mix of international investments can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
And here's a notable job announcement on this Labor Day. The first woman in more than 500 years has become a guard at the Tower of London. 42-year-old Moira Cameron is now a protector of the crown jewels. She's joined the ranks of the Beefeaters, a nickname for the guards thought to refer to their ample portions at the king's table. The job requires 22 years of service to Her Majesty's Army. Cameron busted through the glass ceiling wearing a top hat with red trim. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. U.S. markets were closed today for the Labor Day holiday. Our producers include Megan Larson, Caitlin Carroll, Jennifer Collins, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Next time on the program, minority models stroll down the catwalks of Paris.
It's a form of recognition of the fact that they are in France. They are French. They belong to France.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you enjoyed your holiday. Join us again tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.